When the fruit and nut trees in California's Central Valley explode into mile upon mile of beautiful blossoms, the bees simply must be there. That leads us to ask, how do bees get to being there for all those blossoms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1385th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Santiago who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, a couple of years ago, I attended the World Ag Expo in Tulare, California. Like many farm and ag shows, the expo took place in February, which in California meant spring was just around the corner. What I saw on my drive through the Great Central Valley was mile after mile of bare naked fruit and nut trees. Still, I could see that a few of those trees were testing the season with a blossom or two, and it was obvious that all of the trees were getting ready to explode into color. That explosion of color happened while I was attending the expo, which made the ride out of the valley a sight to behold. The season for making fruit and nuts was on. However, a short day or two later, the rains came, and they were big rains that flooded the Central Valley, turning farms into lakes and drowning out many of the bee colonies. It was another of the many natural disasters that make farming a gamble, and not a sure thing at all. Sometimes a gamble is lost. And here it is, spring again, and all those trees in California's Central Valley are getting ready to explode into color. But wait, what's this? A four-day river of rain is said to be headed this way. And so we ask, how will the bees get to being there for all those blossoms? Well, today we are most grateful to have a commercial apiarist who is willing to step forward with answers. He is Jason Miller, the owner of Miller Honey Farms in Newcastle, California. Jason, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate you having me on.
You're the first apple engineer that I've ever met that became an apiarist. How the heck did that happen?
Yeah, that's quite a job change. There were a lot of people that left during the time I was there, but I was the only one that left to become a beekeeper. So my colleagues were a little dumbfounded at that choice. But no, this genetic defect is running our family for five generations now. My great grandfather started with just six beehives, traded those for some bags of oats back in 1894.
It was the five bags of oats for seven colonies of bees.
Yep. And that was the birth of Miller Honey Farms. And fortunately, someone with a great camera and an eye for it back then documented a lot of those early days of horse-drawn, you know, carriages, the first extraction facilities. And, you know, some of those early beekeeping days were documented through photography that are just priceless. That's kind of where we got our humble origins. And I'm a fifth generation in the family. So when my dad approached me, I grew up working bees somewhat in the summer and when school wasn't in. But I kind of always had this idea that I was going to go off and do something bigger and change the world in some other way. And so I went to college and did an MBA. Out of college, I was hired on as a cryptography engineer at Apple and spent some amazing years there at Apple, only about 5 years, but saw the time when the iPhone was introduced, the Apple Watch, so many changes in technology during the time I was that short window from 2007 to 2012 when I came to our family business, you know, wanted to kind of try it out and convince my wife, well, let's just go do it for a year and we'll go back to the tech thing. But, you know, at least I won't let the 120-year legacy die without giving it a shot. And here we are about 15 years later and quite enjoying it. It's been a great transition, really good for our family. And I've really enjoyed the challenges and opportunities that this agricultural world brings.
You know, looking at your history and trying to read between the lines, you're kind of like a colony of bees.
Yeah, I suppose.
in that you keep growing and splitting off and moving into different areas, but keep making the honey, right?
Yeah, we've been doing that for a long time. And the business has certainly transitioned over the years, as pollination wasn't a big component of beekeeping. You know, when for my grandfather or any of those prior generations, it really was my dad's era when there was a little bit of pollination income opportunity here in California. And so they started bringing the bees out here. I was born in North Dakota, but grew up my winters and my schooling here in Northern California. So I've spent a lot of my life doing this migratory lifestyle that our bees do, back and forth from California to North Dakota, kind of seeing those two worlds from two very different perspectives.
Yeah, having been raised in Montana, you're right. They are very different when it gets right down to it. But the bees are bees, and they're all after one thing, and that's to make honey, I guess.
Yeah, that and pollen. Pollen and honey are the what feeds them. And, you know, kids, when I teach in the schools, they're always shocked to learn that the bees aren't making that honey for all of us. You know, that's what they eat as well. So yeah, a lot of times they have to start at the basics, you know, that you ask the average adult, where's honey come from, you know, and it's like you've heard it, but, you know, understanding that that's nectar from flowers that the bees have gathered and brought back. And then same with the pollen, you know, they're gathering that pollen. That's sort of their protein source, is the pollen. And then the honey is their calories, their energy source. And a diet of those two, with the pollen providing the essential amino acids and the honey providing those calories, that's their diet. And fortunately, they're really hard workers, and they make a real excess of honey, far more than they need to survive. So we're able to harvest some of that and enjoy it ourselves.
Well, good. Really quickly, I wanted to back up in my introduction. I introduced the great floods of the Central California, and you talked about your job is part pollinator and part honey maker, correct? Honey gatherer,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, and more pollination. You know, that has risen in priority and in percentage of income over the years, to where it makes up nearly 60 to 70% of our income now is derived from pollination of the various crops. And so that is, yes, a major key component. And these, you know, you never know what the weather's going to do in California in this February, March timeframe, where, you know, spring is coming on, and sometimes it's torrential rain, and some years it's scathing desert without, you know, much precipitation at all. And so we've seen it all.
And in 2023, what did you see? What I saw was a lot of farms got turned into lakes, and the poor honeybees floated away with the floods.
Yes, they certainly did. And again, this year in 2025, we've had some really heavy rainfall in the last few weeks, and a number of beehives. I have pictures from a lot of other beekeepers that we have kind of a group text thread, and a lot of their hives flooding out and washing away, where, you know, levees break or whatever canal overruns, and that is certainly a risk. We had some where again a levee broke in the Woodland, California area, so again Northern California, and ripped through an orchard that we pollinate there. And we lost to the tune of about 200 beehives and they weren't just flooded. Usually, you know, when that happens, the bees can climb up to the top box, you know, and still survive. Or if it gets really bad, you know, they will drown. But this was such a raging river that it took the boxes all the way out through the orchard and carried some of them, you know, nearly a quarter mile away that we were recovering boxes. So none of those bees survived, sadly. And that is something that we try to prevent by, you know, not placing them in flood prone areas, or, you know, stacking them on pallets. But when something like that, when a levee breaks and the water comes raging through, it takes out about everything.
Also mentioned the fact that farming, because of nature, because you're out in nature, really is a gamble. And sometimes it just doesn't pay off, right?
Yeah, that's well, and you know, you're always experimenting, and you never kind of, just as soon as I think we've got this figured out and understand these bees, and you know, they throw you a curveball. We're in this global world where, you know, disease and blessings and curses, you know, spread very quickly. And so we're dealing with disease, pathogens, parasites that the bees are just not used to dealing with. And there's new threats, you know, always coming and on the horizon, that makes it, you know, much more difficult. My dad always talks about there's the current big pest that has been since my childhood is the Varroa mite. And my dad always talks about the easy days of beekeeping before the mite came. And then, you know, it became hard. You know, he says any idiot could keep bees before Varroa mite. And then it became hard.
That's what I was wondering, whether there was a situation where in the older days, like your grandfather, there would be, you had the diseases that you have now, and evidently not.
Yeah. Yep.
So you're
pretty no, you know, they did have some, and some diseases they dealt with have been eradicated, and new ones have come along. But it's an ever moving target. And, you know, the losses that many have heard about, you know, in the news over the past 10 years, have certainly been a new thing. You know, my grandfather, he experienced about a 5% loss year over year. That was kind of the average. And we see if we take a year, we're typically to the tune of about 50 to 60% colony loss over the year. So we all beekeepers have had to adapt to that new normal where we're rebuilding colonies constantly. It's not like you just need to rebuild 10% of your operation one time in the year and then you're okay like it used to be. It's a constant where we're creating splits from strong hives, introducing new queens, and then constantly treating for disease, on the lookout for disease, and working really hard to maintain, you know, healthy colonies. It's not so simple anymore.
Any sign of a super queen that can put up with the Varroa mite?
Yeah. So there's a lot of people breeding for resistance, you know, and there are different races of bees from different areas of the world, and some are more adept. And you know, it comes with trade-offs. And so, you know, you might have some bees that are really good at controlling mites, but they're extremely volatile, you know, and hostile bees, and so they're no fun to be around and work. Or they may be terrible honey producers, or they might swarm very readily, you know. And so you can solve one thing, but the difficult part is getting a honeybee line that is docile and easy to work with, great honey producers. You know, they have good resistance to mites. You know, they build up nice colonies. All those traits together are rather difficult. And because bees open mate and they mate with many partners, the queens, it's very hard to control those genetics.
There you
know,
you
it's
go.
It's yeah. Well,
with that, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'd like to have our guest take us to the great Central Valley of California and talk about what difference almonds have made to the trade of keeping bees. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. We are with Jason Miller, who is the owner of Miller Honeybee Farms in Newcastle, California. Kind of a two-level job when it gets right down to it. One job is you're a pollinator. The other job is that you're a honeybee, a honey gatherer. And so there's two different, are they really different?
Yeah, they certainly are. What you're focusing on and, you know, where you're placing the bees and how you care for the bees is certainly different depending on whether, you know, you're in the time of year to make excess honey and harvest honey or whether you're fulfilling pollination contracts. Yeah, it's two very different worlds.
Well, good. It seems like the pollination part of your business grew with the almond industry in the Central Valley. Is that a fair assessment?
That is very much so. Yes. The success of commercial beekeeping, you know, financial success is really ridden on the back of the almond explosion. You know, 80% of the world's almonds come from California, and they're one of California's, if not their largest export commodity, one of the top export commodities of California. And so it's a huge driver for the entire California economy. And then, you know, they're enjoyed all over the world. As I mentioned, most of them go to export around the Asian nations and around the world. So as that demand for bees has grown, you know, you can plant your almond trees, but if you don't have pollinators there, those trees do not set a nut. They absolutely need the bees to cross pollinate. And so as that acreage increased dramatically through the 90s and 2000s, that demand for bees began to outstrip the bee population, you know, of the beekeepers here in California. And so it became financially viable for beekeepers from as far as Florida and Maine and New York to bring bees all the way to California. And now that single crop of the almonds brings the majority of the beehive colonies from the entire United States come to California to simply pollinate that one crop. So it is the world's largest pollination event throughout the year that occurs during this time of the almond bloom in California. And that's because every acre of almonds requires two beehives. And that, as I mentioned, that acreage has exploded over the years. And so it's just brought in more and more bees to satisfy that growing almond acreage.
How long does the bloom last for the almond trees?
You know, we hope on a normal year, like this year's been progressing quite nicely, where right now, depending on where we are in the state, up north, those trees are probably 40-50% along in their bloom. And down south, they're still only at maybe 1-5% bloom here in February 12th. Now, my dad always said Valentine's Day is kind of the day to mark as the typical full bloom of almonds. So I've always had that, you know, in the back of my mind. But some years we get this flash bloom where say the weather's cold and dreary and the trees aren't moving along, those buds haven't opened up. And then we get 3 or 4 days of 75 degrees and full sun, and they'll just, all the blossoms will open up at once. And it's kind of, you know, feast and famine, where those orchards look like a food desert to the honeybee before that, before those trees open up. And then, you know, it's a smorgasbord of more than they can eat. And then, you know, just like that, it's over. But what we hope for are years like this, where the bloom will last, you know, 2 to 3 weeks and come on rather slowly. And that way, you know, it sustains the bees on their diet, and they're able to gather everything, and the trees, you know, set a great crop because the bees have the time to really get through there and pollinate each one of those blossoms.
How do you go about getting the bees there? I mean, you truck your bees in from North Dakota?
Yeah, so we overwinter our bees in North Dakota inside, and this is a rather modern. The Canadians have been doing this for a long time due to their extreme winters, but we winter our bees indoors in a climate controlled building that we own on our property there in North Dakota. We maintain them at about 40 degrees Fahrenheit, 10 degrees centigrade throughout winter. So we'll put them in about the middle of October, and we won't pull them out until the middle of January. So they spend a good long time indoors in the dark. We don't feed them. We don't open them. We don't touch them. And those bees, the queens go dormant. The bees kind of go dormant and cluster up for the winter. And we know they're safe and protected. They're in an ideal environment, not under a snowdrift out in the Midwest. So when the bloom time comes, you know, mid-January, we load those onto semi-trucks. We have a few of our own semi-trucks, and then we contract out with other bee haulers. And basically, you can put about 500 beehives on a semi, and then we ship those out to California. So it's about a 2.5-day trip out here. We put a net over the top. And if you look at Interstate 80 and coming into California during that January, February timeframe, about every third or fourth semi is a load of bees, but you don't really recognize it unless your eye is tuned for that. You know, I can point them out all day long and people go, "I've never seen a load of bees." And I say, "Yeah, you've seen a lot of them out there. You just don't recognize, you know, what it looks like. They have a tarp, they have a mesh tarp over the top of them. So that's not immediately obvious, but yeah, it takes about 30 to 40 semis to get all of our bees out here into the almond orchards, and then we go through them and kind of see how things look from the winter, you know. Right. What was our survival over winter, and how strong are the colonies?
And then, of course, you have to have an agreement with an orchardist or somebody who's growing almonds.
Certainly. And there's a number that we have direct contracts with the grower, you know, family farm of growers that have been doing this for a long time, and we, you know them, they know us, and we've been pollinating for them, you know, for 20 plus years in some cases. In other cases, you know, it's not so direct. It might be through a broker, or they're so large, they have intermediaries and all of that. But yeah, at the end of the day, you have to have an agreement with, to put your bees in an orchard somewhere and then, you know, go through those hoops to have strong enough colonies and get them there when they need them, and then get paid on those from those orchards that we pollinate. Mm-hmm.
So is it kind of does a price war ever break out for bees?
Yeah, you know, it used to be that there was enough of bees, and so, you know, the prices were pretty soft, and it was kind of, you were hoping to get good contracts. Those tables have turned in the last, you know, 10 years, where most years you can rent every beehive that you have alive, and the price war is kind of, you know, the pollination prices have gone up and up and up, and the beekeeper has had the upper hand in that, because of the shortage of bees to pollinate all of the trees that are out there. And this year is shaping up to be another year of quite large bee shortages. And so I've seen a lot of orchards even now do not have bees in them right now. And the bloom, as I mentioned, in some parts of the state is nearly half over, and in other parts, you know, it's just beginning. But by now, you would typically see bees in most all the orchards. But there is quite a shortage. This year has been a bad year for bee losses, poor overwintering strength, and so the bee industry is kind of going through a little bit of a crisis this year as we move into the almonds, and, mm-hmm. and the bees just aren't there. The bees that are there, they're not as strong as what we'd like them to be.
It's almost like farm labor in some situations. Where there's farm labor, you can have a farm, but where there's no farm labor, you don't get to have a farm very much. So when you have when you don't have bees on your trees, you don't have a crop. As simple as that.
Yep, that's absolutely correct. And so, you know, we were lucky. We've had really great bees this winter. I won't say lucky, but, you know, we did all the things necessary to ensure that we had some great bees coming in this year. And so our losses were pretty minimal, and our bee strength was good. But we've had our own share of poor, difficult years, you know. And so this year we were able to cover for a lot of other beekeepers that, you know, were short on their numbers or didn't have colonies of sufficient strength for pollination. And so we're kind of the ones covering for a lot of people that are struggling this year. But as I mentioned, you know, it comes around and gets everybody at some point. You're going to stub your toe.
It always seems like what is a good year for one farmer is a bad year for another farmer, and vice versa. When you have trouble getting a crop in, somebody's going to make more money because they got a crop in. And so,
And so this may, you know, if a whole bunch of these orchards go without bees, the almond price has been a little soft the last few years. Yep. And, And, you know, if all these orchards go with no bees and then they don't produce any almonds, well, that's going to be good for the growers that did get bees and did secure those contracts early on, because, you know, that price could very well shoot up as that supply dwindles due to a lack of pollinators this year.
So when the bloom is off the almond trees, what do you do with all your bees?
That's where things get a little more complicated. You know, right now, everything that we have is here in the almonds. Now, after the almonds are done, we send, just for easy numbers, we send about a third of them up to the state of Washington. And up there, we pollinate. What's the big crop of Washington?
Apples.
Apples. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we go up there and pollinate apples and cherries up in Washington. Then we move some into the prunes here in California. That's another crop that comes on right after the almonds. The reason we don't talk too much about that is at that point, there's a lot of bees available and the prices aren't that, they're just a fraction of what almond prices are. And so those don't really help the bottom line of a beekeeper a whole lot. It's just, you know, places that we go with the bees. And obviously, you know, we need the bees and all those other crops, but they're not the cash crop like the almonds, are. And so the prunes of California take some of ours. And then the other third, if a third go up to Washington and a third stay here in California pollinating prunes and a few other small crops, the other third we bring around to our home base here in California. That's in Newcastle, California in Placer County. And that's what we use to split those hives and rebuild from our losses. And so over winter, you know, we've lost thousands of hives on an average year. And those hives need to be rebuilt. Otherwise, we're just going to go down, down, down every year in our numbers. And so our big, what we call nuking event or splitting event happens here after the almonds. That's typically in the April, May timeframe. Around Placer County, we have all of our little bee yards, and we'll go to those yards where there was maybe 48 hives, and we'll split each of those 48 hives two or three ways to increase and make up for those losses that we took over winter. So that's kind of the birth of new colonies, and it's springtime and everything's growing and blossoming, and those queens sense that the days are getting longer, and there is, you know, lots of resources coming into the beehive, and so it's a great time of growth where we can build new colonies up to rebuild our numbers.
Is that a honey season for you?
Yeah, so the bees are making honey. You know, they make honey in the almonds, they make honey in the apples, they make honey during this time that we're splitting, but we don't harvest any of that honey. It's honey for them. It isn't such an excess to where, you know, we could harvest some, but when you're splitting colonies and trying to grow new colonies, that takes a lot of honey for the bees to grow new babies. You know, they're feeding a huge nursery. It's you know, as like any mom with a ton of offspring, you know, that just takes a lot of resources that are being dumped into those baby beehives. And so everything that they're making is going to build up those baby beehives. So yes, they are making honey, but it's all being consumed by the bees, and we don't harvest any of that all the way till we get through the nuking or splitting period here in California, and through the Washington apple pollination and through the California prune pollination season. And that's when we ship, and this would now be into June. We send everything out to North Dakota, kind of the central North Dakota, again on semis, load them up 500 hives at a time, haul them all out to North Dakota, which is the number one honey producing state in the U.S.
How is that?
Yeah.
What makes North Dakota the number one? And I've seen reports that Miller sells a lot of honey out of North Dakota.
We certainly do. Yes. Yeah. We do make quite a bit of honey, not as much per hive as it was when I was a kid. I mean, the numbers are just insane. The amount of honey that one beehive could make back then. But you know, the landscape has changed and the bee health has changed, and to the point where, you know, a lot of years we're making maybe 40 pounds of honey per beehive. When I was a kid, it was very common to average over 100 to 120 pounds per beehive. But those days are past us. But it's still, even we run about 15,000 colonies. And so for easy numbers, if we make 40 pounds of honey per colony, that's about 500,000 pounds of honey. And some years we do better than that. And some years we don't do that well. But yeah, North Dakota is great because it rains a lot. So a lot of just natural rainfall through the summer, whereas most parts of the U.S. are quite dry. When you get into June, July, and August, you're not going to have rainfall in most states in any excess amount. And then there's just a lot of open forage land, a lot of cattle pasture where, you know, alfalfa is being grown. There's wild sweet clover that's blossoming. There's a lot of land that's just put into reserve for habitat, whether that's a bee and butterfly habitat or pheasants forever, or the conservation reserve program of the USDA. And so there's a lot of land that just is very good bee forage, bee habitat out there in North Dakota. And those things combine to make it an excellent place for producing honey in the summer.
Mm-hmm. So is there a crop that is central to all of that honey making, or is it just everything?
Yeah, no, it's not everything. It's number one would be alfalfa and yellow sweet clover. So alfalfa that's grown as feed for the cattle is a great nectar source for the bees. And then yellow sweet clover, which is just a volunteer, typically grows in the ditch banks and grows in cattle pasture, is excellent. As far as planted crops, there's buckwheat, which is a good honey producing crop. Sunflowers used to be good honey producing, but they've GMO'd those in the last about 10 years to where they hardly produce. They figured out a way to get those flowers to put their resources towards producing more kernels and bigger kernels and all of that, and not quote unquote wasting their resources with nectar. And so we really don't get much of a sunflower crop anymore, but canola is a big crop up in North Dakota that produces a lot of honey. And unfortunately, where we are, a lot of what used to be pasture land has been put into corn and beans. So corn for the ethanol and then soybeans for the soybean oil. And so a lot of what was good honey pasture and good bee pasture has gone away as those crops have taken over and become more valuable. It's a lot of corn and soybean, which doesn't provide anything of value to pollinators. There isn't much nectar or pollen in either of those.
Right. Well, with that, we're going to take a quick break. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today, we're talking about pollinating crops and making honey. And there are two different things with Jason Miller, who is the owner of Miller Honey Farms in Newcastle, California. But it's also a large extended clan of honey makers throughout the United States. When we come back, we'll talk about making honey and money. Do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We're talking about honey and money and bees and pollination and the huge almond crop in California that is made possible by bees that travel in from North Dakota and, heck, New York City and just about everywhere in the country. They come arriving from everywhere to do one thing, and that is to pollinate the almond crop. And then what? Away we go. So we're with Jason Miller, like I said, former Apple engineer who turned back to his farm family's core business, which was bees and honey. Your company headquarters, as it might be, is in North Dakota. Is that true, Jason?
That is correct, yes. My grandfather, we were in Idaho. So it was originally started in Utah, and then my great-grandpa moved to Idaho. And so my dad was born up in Idaho and then started going out to North Dakota, hearing that, you know, there was a lot of good honey pasture out there. And then, of course, California with the boom of pollination. And so been coming to California since the 70s and North Dakota since the late 60s. And then, you know, for our business, we're primarily centered in Gackle, North Dakota, the bustling town of Gackle, North Dakota, population about 300. And that is our company headquarters, and that's where the bees spend the majority of the time. And we also have a satellite office here in Newcastle, California.
Mm-hmm. And that's your office. So,
yes.
So how many millers are working in this bee business?
Just right. So my dad's still around both in the bees and here kind of advising us and shaping decisions, but he's very involved in, I would say, governmental affairs and industry affairs, boards and research. And so he's been a good proponent of the industry in that regard. And he's less now attached to the day to day. I have a business partner, Ryan, who we work together and kind of split about all the responsibilities. When we talked about pollination, he kind of runs all the hives south of Sacramento, California, and I run all the hives north of Sacramento during the almond period.
So that would be the Sacramento and San Joaquin valleys, which is,
yes,
for those who are not from California, wondering why, how could there be two valleys in one valley?
Yeah, a whole lot of just amazing geography in the state of California. You know, everything from the other day, we were just commenting that we were in the snow skiing, and, you know, about 40 minutes later, we were down sitting in the sun in shorts and a t-shirt. So it's pretty amazing the variety of landscape there is here in California. And yeah, a lot of very fertile valley where, you know, the food basket of America and the world is there in the San Joaquin Valley, and where so many of our specialty crops of fruits, nuts, and all the healthy things we enjoy in the produce section come out of that California fertile soil.
However, there was something on your website that caught my attention. It reads as follows: due to population growth in Northern California and monoculture farming practices in North Dakota, it is becoming increasingly difficult to find suitable locations and keep bees healthy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, these large swaths of land that typically, you know, were cattle ranches or just unincorporated areas where there wasn't really development, you know, development has creeped in, and bee yards. Everybody likes the idea of bees as long as it's not in their backyard is what it comes down to. And so, you know, whereas we used to have plenty of area to place beehives, that's gotten a little more difficult as property is sold and broken up and homes go in and neighborhoods go in. And so, yes, it is a little more challenging to find open agricultural suitable lands to place the bees. And then the diet of the bees and pollinators, you know, has suffered as the kind of monoculture agricultural cropping has come about, where things are very efficient. You know, on the one hand, we are producing more food per acre than we ever have, but we've become so efficient that, you know, everything is Roundup ready. And so there are no weeds, there are no volunteer anything. We're with precision GPS guided planting and harvest equipment. We can plant and harvest every square inch of the land, which doesn't leave a lot at the borders and edges for, you know, pollinators and habitat and others. So I think there needs to be a little bit of a shift back to a better balance in our system, where we're not so efficient to where we're you know, monopolizing every square inch. And as I mentioned, a lot of times in a kind of monoculture way where you have hundreds and hundreds of acres of one crop. And so that looks like a food desert, you know, to most of the wildlife and pollinators and insects, except for that short time when that crop might be in bloom or you know, or available.
I guess a great example of that would be the bloom on the almonds in the Central Valley. When it goes off, it's truly spectacular, something to see. Worth yes. driving there to see it, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
But then it's just one thing. It's
right.
almost like living on hamburgers and nothing else or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, mac and cheese, three meals a day, you know, every day. And it definitely is a healthier diet. You know, the pollen of almond trees is a very nutritious pollen. And so the bees do well. But yes, this monoculture, nothing is designed to eat one, you know, food diet all the time. And so having this variety of crops is much healthier for the overall ecosystem, but it's not nearly as efficient, you know, and it's that balance of efficiency versus a diverse biosphere.
Do you think the monoculture has an impact on bee health? You mentioned the fact that you're losing more bees now than you did in the past. Do you think having that just that one crop in so many locations has anything to do with the bee health?
Yeah, and not necessarily, you know, that the almonds have had any detrimental, but I would say, you know, where we've seen in North Dakota where everything has gone to corn and beans, and they're planting things that, you know, typically weren't planted and planting extremely efficiently, that has certainly impacted the health of bees, just because there isn't as much out there for them to eat and the variety isn't there. But yeah, bees have been suffering from a lot of different things. So there isn't really one thing I think we can point our finger at and say, oh, well, if it wasn't for this, you know, otherwise we would have solved it. If it was simple, we would have solved bee health. But really it's, you know, queen longevity has suffered, as I mentioned earlier, pathogens and parasites that the bees have not dealt with in the past. I've been heard it phrased the four P's. And so one being pathogen, parasites being something of one of the P's, a second P of the bee suffrage is poor nutrition. So that kind of is that monoculture, lack of diverse forage. That that they often deal with. And then, now all of a sudden I sit here, you know, it's like you rehearse or you say these things and then they escape you. Pathogens and parasites, poor nutrition. Oh, and pesticides, is another, you know, area that certainly we have to be careful with. And we've gotten better systems to get notified of pesticide sprays. Pesticides have gotten less toxic in some regard. But we still do get kills from pesticide spray. And, you know, it's really difficult to kill the right bug when you've got bees and other foragers, you know, in a crop and you've got to kill some certain nasty thing. It's difficult to kill some bugs and not kill others. And so we do have much better targeting of pesticides these days. But that isn't to say that the bees aren't still, you know, negatively impacted.
I would suspect so. One of the things in turning from the bees to trade, I've noticed over the past decade or so that China has become a big player in the honey market. Has that had an impact on you?
Oh, certainly. Yes. Yeah. They, you know, with labor costs around the world, honey is a world market. We don't produce enough here, and we consume more honey in the U.S. than we produce. So we can't as easily just shut off to foreign imports. Now, the sugar industry has done an excellent job of that. So we pay dearly for our sugar in the United States, and it's a protected market. And so they don't have to compete with the rest of the world like we do on the honey side. And because we import a lot of honey from around the world, a lot of other areas have very low labor costs, whereas we deal with very high regulatory and labor costs here in the United States. It's really driven down the price of honey over the years. And that, therefore, if it wasn't for the almonds and the pollination, you know, there would not be any commercial beekeeping anymore. It just wouldn't even be close to profitable enough to run a beekeeping operation anymore. Whereas in my grandfather's time, you know, the main income was honey. That was really it. And a few extras, you know, with wax and maybe selling some bulk bees or, you know, some excess from the hive, some hive products. But really, it came down to honey. And as I mentioned, those dynamics have shifted. And fortunately, pollination has taken that place, because with honey coming into the U.S. at, you know, 40 cents a pound from the world market, we cannot produce it anywhere near that cost. The inputs are way too high in the United States to produce honey at those amounts or that cost.
And you talked about the regulatory environment as well. What kind of regulations could there possibly be on bees and honey?
You know, a lot of it comes down to running a business. Gosh, I have more permits and trainings and fees than the list goes on and on. I wouldn't even be able to think of half of them off the top of my head, from burn permits to pesticide licenses to trucking licenses to weight permits to, you know, here in California, obviously is much more regulated and way higher cost than in North Dakota. So as my dad always said, ABC, anywhere but California, when you're looking at how to, you know, where you want to kind of build out and spend the majority of your time and effort and infrastructure, do it outside of California, sadly. And it didn't used to be like that in California, but it is now. And so recently, for example, California passed some new overtime laws in agriculture. And so that has made the cost of labor in ag very expensive in California. And again, outside of California, we don't have those overtime laws. So the employees are able to work more hours and we're able to get more done and kind of control those costs. But yeah, California has become very, very expensive to do business in. And there are just a lot of, you know, it's a little fee here and it's a little permit there and it all adds up. And yeah, it's become quite expensive to comply, not only cost dollar wise, but time wise. There's so much to, you know, being inspected all the time and your housing inspected and your vehicles inspected and your facilities inspected, and just complying with all of that is quite egregious.
in that respect, it would seem you're kind of well positioned because you're headquartered in North Dakota.
Yes. Yeah, that wasn't by accident. That wasn't by accident. But let me say that. But you know, we still have a big presence, you know, here in, sure, in California. Yeah, we also grow citrus. So we have about 1,200 mandarin orange trees that are here in California, and we can't exactly pick those up and move them out to North Dakota when we take the bees and bring them back. So we definitely have a footprint here in California, and you know, we navigate through it, but it has gotten much more expensive, and we're doing less and less in California as it's become more difficult.
Yeah, I don't think those mandarin orange trees would appreciate wintering in North Dakota, even if you have a certainly great not big barn to put them in. So
certainly not.
Looking into the future, and the Miller family in farming and honey, you see a great future in being an apiarist and being a beekeeper and being a honey maker.
You know, I hope so. My kids are involved in the business like I was in my teenage years. My oldest is 16 and my youngest is 9 years old. And so they're getting their feet wet and working in the summer when they're off school in the family business. And I hope that it can continue for another 130 years. You know, who knows? Because if you would have told my grandpa that only 30% of his income would come from honey, you know, he would have just laughed you out of the room. And so with pollination, that has now come up as a question mark in the future. There's a lot of new varieties that are gene edited or GMO to where they don't require pollinators. They're able to self-pollinate. So these are self-pollinating varieties of almonds, for example. And so we may very well not need the kinds of bee numbers that we have today if they eventually, you know, get this, crack that nut, as to say, to where the trees just don't require us bringing in these pollinators. So who knows? I mean, that's definitely a business, you know, something I can see on the horizon and a potential risk to this industry. But, you know, we've evolved over the years, and beekeeping when my great grandfather started till now looks very, very different. And so who knows what it'll look like for the next generation. But I hope it can continue.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.